Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Peterson's strobe tuners are quite literally the best tuners in the world. Available in the form of the Stomp HD pedal, the Strobo Clip Clip-On, and even an iOS and Android-supported strobe tuning app. The Strobo Stomp HD comes in an incredibly high-quality standard effects pedal size chassis with an absolutely whopping LCD screen size and user-defined variable color display, featuring over 100 exclusive sweetened tunings designed to help correct inherent tuning issues exhibited by many instruments. And the guided tunings mode, my favorite, displays numeric string values instead of traditional note names, making for surefire, intuitive, and rapid retuning to any number of open and alternative tunings. Peterson tuners make tuning accuracy simple and definite. It's probably the most important part of your pedal board, so why go for anything other than the best? Check them out at petersontuners.com. Hello and welcome to the Guitar Nerds Podcast, the world's number one guitar podcast. I'm your host, Joe Branton, joined this week by Naomi McLeod.
Good evening.
And JD Short.
Hello, I'm your host, JD Short.
yes, probably a little bit croaky there. And welcome, dear listener, welcome to the 17th episode in season two of the Guitar Nerds podcast, which is actually, I think it's on something, this must be like the 350th episode. I really, you know, I appreciate my seriesing hasn't been very good, but I promise you from now on, it's going to be good. A solid 52-ish episodes per season, whatever a year takes. That's how it's going to be, and it's going to be great. So, yes, dear listener, you will have noticed I have got rid of Jay Cross. Mark, I can't remember his surname now.
What was it? It's not Peckham. That's where I am.
Pac-Man?
Yeah, something like that.
Handman.
That's it. I think. Mark Handman's not here, and Matt's also taken it off. So I've called up the Bass Guitar Nerds for us to do another kind of Guitar Nerds Bass Guitar Nerds special, as we're not currently doing a Bass Guitar Nerds series, but we are just around the corner, dear listener, from doing a Bass Guitar Nerds series. First of all, listeners who are guitarists, you know, this is going to be really cool, interesting information. We're going to take loads of questions from the Facebook group this week, and I know a lot of you have been getting into bass a little bit during the pandemic, so this is a podcast for everyone, not just for bass players, although, you know, we will lead with bass guitar related stuff. But yes, there is going to be a new little series of the Bass Guitar Nerds, which we, you know, I thought we should announce on this week's episode, as it is coming. It's round the corner. I did kind of get excited about it and post about it on the Guitar Nerds group, facebook.com/groups/Guitar Nerds forum the other day. We are announcing the Squire Bronco Mod Mode series.
Mod mode.
Exactly. About 5 years ago, when Mark Packham was hosting the podcast, he said we were going to do a... Yeah,
exactly. Mark Handman said that we would be
doing a mod mode series for guitars, and just never came to fruition. Lazy man. But I on the other hand, am introducing the with the help of Naomi and JD, we are going to do a collaborative Bronco mod mode. Kind of like, we'd spoken about it for some time and we were like, yeah, we should definitely do this. And then I think seeing things like Dave Lee's Squire Bronco, the sort of powder blue Bronco with the pink paisley plate, that
beautiful
he'd made
bass.
With
that.
Yeah, oh, it was excellent. So good, wasn't it? It was so yeah. wonderful. And yeah. I kind of we saw that and I was like, no, we actually do have to do the Bronco mod mode and we have to do it now. And also now we've actually got a kind of, there's something to top, you know. We've actually got to make this really, really good. We've got to make this better than Dave Lee's incredible powder blue Eldritch, which is the name of Dave Lee's kind of modding brand. We've got to make it better than that, or try to at least. So we've got three Broncos. We've got three Broncos, and we're going to be. I'm not going to talk about it too much on this podcast because, you know, obviously that's what that podcast is going to be about.
We just won't stop talking once we start talking. Exactly. If we're not careful, we're okay. that excited about this mod mode.
If our group chat's anything to go by, then yeah,
yeah,
probably.
Yeah, if I sound tired, it's because I've been talking for weeks by text with the two guys about this mod mode.
It's going to be great. It's going to be really good. I'm really excited to see what absolutely crazy things we do and how awesome we make our Broncos. Yeah. And then I'm looking forward to making some videos with them afterwards so we can see who's got the best Bronco. I think that's something, dear listener, we're going to be asking you to decide after the three of us have made all of our mods.
That we're going to have a Bronco-off.
We're going to have a Bronco-off. That's what it is. Yeah, oh, that's...
You're welcome. You're welcome, Joe.
That is good. Should we call it the Bronco-off?
A Bronco-off.
Okay, that's fine.
A
Bronco-off. Should it be the Bronco-off instead of the Bronco mod mode?
I feel like we should have listener feedback for that. Mm.
Okay, there we go. Dear listener, let us know. Facebook.com/groups/guitar nerds forum. Should it be the Bronco mod mode? Mod mode is obviously what Mark was going to call the original
Mark Handman
series. Mark Handman was going to call the original series. Should we call it the Bronco mod mode? Should we call it the Bronco-off? Bear in mind, there is the great pedal build-off between me and Matt coming shortly after the Bronco-off.
Oh, yeah, so there is.
It's a similar name as well. But, we see exciting things to come. Exciting things to come.
Mod-off. Bronco mod-off.
The mod-off.
Yeah, the mod-off. Yeah.
I like the use of the Bronco in the word, though. Yeah.
Bronco. Like, for me, it's like the worse the pun, the better the pun.
Oh, exactly.
So, absolutely. Yeah, if we could just keep the puns terrible, that would be ideal for this host, please.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I can't wait. God, I can't wait. Even the few things I've decided for mine, I can't wait to unleash upon the small but friendly world of Bronco mod lovers.
What I'm really looking forward to is the fact that all three of us, I think, have gone for a very different kind of theme and aesthetic overall for the Bronco, which is going to show. I mean, it's such a fantastic instrument as a sort of blank canvas to turn into whatever you want to for a reasonable price. Like, there will always be kind of that thing of, it's a £130 bass. Like, we're spending, you know, way over quadruple on, you know, sort of like each one to mod it. But still, when we're making the basses into fully professional, fully functional instruments, and it's kind of an argument to say this is the cheapest custom shop you can get. And once it's up at a certain standard, it kind of is worth that money, even if it's not, you know, on the secondhand market.
Well, and I think the thing too is, like, I mean, we're doing this as like a full thing. So we're sort of like unveiling our Bronco-offed, you know, like final iterations, right? You know, where it's like the idea, I think too, is to like grab a cheap bass that sounds great for rehearsal. Be like, I want to put a new bridge in. Oh, that's even better. Like, I'm going to do some paint to it. You know, like I think being able to do this over a couple years or when you have time, like, it's just that, like, it's that like project that gives you like constant like engagement in a way that you can always kind of think of like, oh, what else could I do with this? You know, I think like thinking about it that way too is it, like, makes it such a great platform and such a just nice hobby, if nothing else.
Yeah, you know? I totally agree. I think it being such a cheap, for want of a better word, instrument to begin with as well makes it a very accessible mod project. I think you can really drop that fear of, you know, am I ruining an already sort of perfect perfect combination of parts here. It's like, it's fine to begin with. It's incredible value to begin with, but you know, I think you can rest assured you are quite literally improving with each mod, as opposed to, you know, with certain maybe more expensive instruments having a tougher decision in regards to your mods.
It would be more taste changes, you know, when it comes to more expensive instruments, I think. Whereas this, you are literally improving this.
Yes.
Yeah. And I just, permission to whinge / rant a bit, just expanding on something Naomi had said. Thank you. One of the things I keep, you know, just in looking at research or doing some stuff on, like reading about like the Squire, like I come across so many comments that are like, that are either like, well, this is only, you know, like it's only 150 pound bass. Like, why would you bother like doing this to it? To one, I would be like, well, obviously to make it better, so who cares, right? Or there's other stuff was like, well, you want it to retain its original value. And it's like, well, its original value is less than the bridge that I'm putting on. So I can always take this bridge off and make my money back. You know,
you can always rip out that pickup or take off those tuners and make your individual cost back.
It's such a weird thing, and I think it feels so safe to mod as well. You know, like these have every chance of becoming like a classic in a way that no one ever, likely no one at like Fender would have or Squire would have intended. But like it's like what happens with a cult movie, or it's like what happens with something that's like we've all like the people have made this like a cult favorite, and it's, you know, it's got this thing that's like it's almost like you don't have to worry about what you do to it, like in a way, because like at the end of the day, if you were to like put all the stuff back as it was and then be like, oh well, the most you can lose is 150 pounds, you know, like you scratch like an American Fender and someone's like, well, I'm not going to pay that for it, you know. And it's kind of like, okay, well, that feels weird. So yeah, I think it's such a good platform.
I also kind of think that the other part of it that makes it a great platform is I feel like I'm more willing to try things that that I wouldn't necessarily on anything else, like certainly when it comes to even when it comes to refins and stuff. If I was looking at a more expensive instrument, I would be well more obsessed with like, what is a timeless finish for me? What is a finish that I'm going to be happy with in any situation, from sort of playing in my band to sort of doing a demo on YouTube to sitting on my wall. Exactly. But you know, when it comes to sort of this Bronco, I'm like, what is the craziest thing I can think of to repaint this bass with? And I'm enjoying that sort of freedom from being obsessed with making, and this might be a personal thing, but a freedom from being obsessed with making sure the aesthetic fits in with what I want my instrument's aesthetic to be. I know that's not something necessarily everyone thinks about, but you know, I like all my guitars to look a certain way, and I'm enjoying that I can do whatever I want with this and have a bit of fun.
Yeah, completely. I think we're all kind of circling around the same point, but I think the Bronco affords a freedom that other mods don't. And I say that on my second Bronco mod in life.
Yeah, so exactly. Well, super, that's, there you go.
Super this excited for this one.
All inspired by Naomi's incredible Bronco, the wonderful natural finish Bronco, which I guess, are you going to continue to mod that? Like, are there changes that you're going to make to that in the future? You said sort of because you've left the neck as it was, other than the tuners that you've changed, like you've left it in that sort of unfinished state.
Yes, I have. Yeah, I think I just reached a point where it was playing really well, and what I had done to that point was all working. And so I've sort of for different reasons sort of cast it aside for the time being in terms of mods. But yeah, I mean, now that we're into mod mode with our bass guitar nerds Broncos, there are a few things I definitely will in time go back to on my original Bronco. I think I'll probably do something with the saddles on the bridge, and I'll probably sort something with a new nut, I would say, for starters. And then, yeah, might stain the neck. Might get that. What was the name of that amazing product that you talked about before? Was it Axe Wax?
Oh yeah, well, Axe Wax is just a. That's Axe Wax is just like a cleaning product. Actually, I think
there was a stain that you spoke about on the podcast before. That was really cool sounding. I thought you had done a neck with.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I've completely forgotten if I did.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry to put you on the spot.
No, that's no, totally yeah. fine.
I remember us talking about, yeah, I didn't. Because yeah. it's basically just like, it's like an aging... It was an aging
yeah. stain for necks, yeah. yeah. And at the time, I made a little bookmark for coming back to. And
was it tea? Because you could just probably rub some tea on it.
You can,
I mean, one of the most organic mods possible, really. But yeah, to answer your question, Joe, there are definitely further mods I will make. As I said, I just sort of got to a point where I was super happy with how the bass is playing. Still am super happy with how the bass is playing. But yeah, there's always more fun to be had, which is the fun with the Bronco. Additionally, the B90 that I have in there, which I absolutely love, I have thought about maybe sticking a Lazen B90 in instead. Now that Zarek has released,
yes,
has released them. So
well, let's talk about that. I was gonna, yeah. What is the Lazen B90? Is that what it's called? The LZN B90. So I don't know anything about this. Now it's someone on the Facebook group did mention recently whether or not Serik, the single coil pickups were a good replacement pickup for, I think they said, a Gretsch bass. I would check who that was who said that. There's a bad time to do that. Yeah, someone asked anyway. But the I kind of didn't realize that Serik had expanded their bass pickup range to be it's four models now, but what is the Lazen B90 then?
Our friends at iZotope have just made their portable recording solution, the Spire Studio, even better. And the best part is that you can try out the app and recording platform for Spire completely free. Download the iOS app for your phone or tablet today by following links in the description of this podcast, and make sketching down your song ideas incredibly easy and intuitive. Without the Spire, you won't have the mic or preamp, but you'll still have access to the software and effects that can polish your demo recordings more than you probably thought possible. The second generation Spire Studio ups the stakes by offering ultra low noise preamps that offer smooth, quieter recording and increased storage capacity. There's also Spire Pro, an optional subscription service accessed via the iOS app, and personalized soundcheck feature that listens and learns from your voice and environment. Check them out at isotope.com.
So versus the single coil original B90, the Lazen B90 is a humbucker. So essentially a humbucking version of your original, and designed to kind of retain what the B90 offered tonally, but has, I think he's changed the magnets in them. I know that they're now Alnico 8. And yeah, essentially you are retaining the kind of warm fatness, but with a little bit more more attitude, as you would expect from a humbucker. But yeah, I'm super keen to pick one up, given... I mean, I literally fell in love with the original B90 when I got it. The such a hot output. Tonally is just everything you would want in terms of growl when you have the tone open, and just so warm and full when you have the tone rolled back. A humbucking version of same is just a no-brainer to me personally.
Yeah. Yeah, that definitely, I think that kind of, I agree that sort of... It's a bit better as a kind of a multi-use option. I think you've really got...
True.
If you're going for a single, just one single coil in the middle of a bass, you've got to really be invested into the sort of tone and the issues that's going to kind of create.
100%,
With it. Like this this week, I had my first first band practice back with Polymath, and I took the J. Douglas Blunderbird that we'd spoken about, the 32-inch scale, kind of 11-pound. I tell you what, my shoulder is done. 8-hour practice. my left shoulder where it sits, absolutely. I kind of got in it and I was like, yeah, this is an 11-pound bass. And, you know, sort of my guitarist Tim's like, oh, wow, yeah, that does feel heavy. And I'm like, well, he's got like an Empress Wood Telly and an SG Junior. They probably weigh like 4 pounds. I'm like, yeah, I mean, it's 11 pounds. That's, you know, a macho. And I'm thinking, what's the, you know, I've never really cared about bass weight or anything, but also I don't think I've ever worn an 11-pound bass for 8 hours. And my shoulder is like serious problems sleeping the last couple of nights. It is absolutely done in. That's not to dissuade anyone from J. Douglas bassist. I think it's absolutely, I really had a great time playing it. It was fantastic. The reason I mention is because it has a hand wound by J. Douglas, by John Douglas himself, the single coil kind of P90 sized pickup that he has banging in the middle of the body is single coil. So certainly, you know, I've been playing jazz basses for a long time, admittedly single coil, but often EMG loaded, or, you know, almost always with both pickups rolled on, so it hum cancels itself anyway. But just having that single coil in the middle, when I was using some of my drivier sounds and certainly my fuzz sounds, I was dealing with an awful lot of sort of through the amplifiers, which I wasn't used to. So there is definitely an investment with a bass with single coils, where you're going to have to learn to use your effects around the fact that those pickups are a bit noisier.
Yes, that is very true. And in the case of the B90, to be fair, I think a lot of my playing was quite clean and clean and sort of more kind of Motown, warm, fuzzy Jamerson type tones. Interesting point actually that you make, because I'm, you know, being between projects, a project I'm getting into at the moment is a new kind of heavy punk band. So I'll report back on the B90's adventures into heavier tones.
Oh, wonderful. You're going to use that as your main bass for the punk project?
As one of, yeah. So it's going to be a little bit prescribed, because it's one of the band members is doing sort of all of the writing. So I suppose technically I'm sort of going to be continuing my session player adventures, but tonally it'll be certainly a little bit gritty, a little bit more attitude than. I suppose the sort of clean work that I've done to date with the B90. I mean, I'll give you some context. The writer is a bassist himself and usually plays an attitude through.
Yeah, we're talking about Joe Thorpe, and of course he also drops tunes by a step, or he plays in D standard the same as me.
Yes, yes, he does indeed. Yeah, so I mean, a classic mix for him would be, you know, an attitude through a Tech 21 Doug into. Into his barefaced setup with a quilter head. So, you know, you're talking really, really, really well put together, high gain, sort of scratchy scratchy, lightly driven tones. So it's going to be an interesting adventure, both in tuning and in tone. For
I was going to say, you're going to have to try and get the Bronco successfully down to D standard.
I am. For this. Yeah, I am indeed, and I think I'm going to have to copy your string setup, Joe, to see how we go.
That's it. I do think it's such a shame that you can't get a standard. Like, you can't get an off-the-shelf set of strings for anyone playing short scale who doesn't want to be in E standard. It just seems like such a mad thing. It's like, really? Is music that narrow that people have to go to a custom shop to get anything that drop tunes on a short scale?
I completely agree. It is an actual gap in the market. I mean, I think, you know, I've spent years helping customers get custom sets who've had individual string needs, and any brands I've been able to work with in stores previously, I've always gotten really stuck into the single string market for customers, so that they could come back and know that they could get their sets through us. But yeah, completely agree. Short scale custom sets and short scale heavier sets, there are not enough out there currently.
I mean, I totally agree that I think single strings, certainly for a shop, like, that's one of the best things you can do, because it's, there's so many different sets where I'm like, actually, I want like a 42. I don't want a 40 or a 45, you know, or I want, you know, some, I don't want to buy four sets of strings so that I can get like one thing. But I'm curious, because like from like a string manufacturer, like, perspective, it's like, well, how many people are playing a short scale bass that are also detuning? I think it's much more common now, you know, and I think it's just a thing that people have to, like, it feels like that's, you know, it feels like turning like a massive ocean liner, kind of like, be like, well, now we have to retool and make different, you know, like, we have to reset our machines to do this. But it's because I also think, like, you know, if you're playing short scale, I mean, granted, there's been a much bigger short scale boom in the last couple of years, but, you know, sort of thinking of short scale, it's like, if I think of short scale, I think of like 60s. I think of like, you know, I'm thinking more like into my ear, like Duck Dunn vibes than I am like, you know, some like doom rockers necessarily. And I could potentially, you know, like, I'm probably wrong, but, you know, like, it's also just like, that's my connotation with it. It's like, oh, someone's playing like, they're playing like a early 70s throwback, you know, like, it's not necessarily like, I'm not necessarily thinking someone's like, you know, like in drop A and playing a short scale four string.
Yeah, absolutely. Like and I think that's kind of what's changing, is the attitudes towards short scales as much. I don't think there's ever been an issue with short scales, but I think you're absolutely right. Almost, I don't know whether they fell out of favor first and then people started judging them as being two-dimensional instruments, or if people started judging them like that first and so companies stopped making the instruments. But I feel like short scale basses at the moment are shedding this image of not being great. And it's kind of like, I guess, I feel like short scale basses are kind of going through at the moment what digital amplification started to go through in, you know, the early 2010s, where you've got sort of a purist market, you know, group of people being like, they just don't sound as good as, you know, proper ones. And then this is actually, you know, we were going to answer a question on this later, which I commented something very similar on this when talking about short scales, where it's kind of like, when it comes to today and the fact that, you know, talking about strings, I think Stringjoy, a fantastic US string brand who really sorted me out with some amazing strings, the short and medium scale 65 to 120s that I have, so I can get to D standard. The fact that didn't really cost me any more than buying an off-the-shelf set, you know, especially if you're ordering a few sets at a time, it kind of, you know, the postage gets eaten up in that anyway. So it's very effective. When you think that you can get those strings and you can have a short scale and you can be in the same tunings if you want to drop tune, or you can at least have the same string tension if that's your kind of issue.
Yeah.
I'm at a point where I'm like, I don't know, what is the downside now? What is the thing? What is the downside? This thing's easier to play. I can move around the neck quicker. The fundamentals are stronger. you can get a heavier gauge string, which is going to replace maybe some of those, because, you know, on short scale string, short scale basses, I think a lot of the fact that they have a fatter, lower presence is almost to do with the floppiness of the string. I don't know if that's technically correct, but I feel like that's a thing. But because you can have heavier gauge strings now, you can make short scale basses as brittle and aggressive as their sort of longer scale counterparts. I'm kind of running out of reasons to not think that they are equally every bit as good.
Yeah, I completely agree, Joe. Also, the reason I went quiet for the last few moments is as soon as we began speaking about strings, I just quietly went onto the Stringjoy site and have added a custom set to my cart as you've been speaking. See, Joe, I learned from the best with this add to cart stuff. I used to think you were absolutely ridiculous doing your shopping during podcast episodes, but here I am.
It's terrible, yeah.
Also, I think that just speaks to how efficient the Stringjoy website is.
In mere
moments, you too can have your own custom set of short scale.
It does completely. I know I used to, so when I was speaking about sort of helping customers get their custom sets through, you know, stores I worked for in previous years, I remember Daydario were superb with their kind of single string offerings, and so were Elixir at the time, and they just happened to be kind of two of the much bigger companies that we were working with as a sort of a high street store. But Stringjoy did pop in, I remember, once or twice, and I think we got I remember we got some samples through, and I mean, as you know, sometimes maybe things just don't quite align for the store and a company to begin doing business at that time. But yeah, I remember thinking these guys seem super cool. So it's really, really good to see them kind of gaining popularity and going so strong. But go on. No, I was just going to say to get back to the sort of general short scale argument that you were making, Joe. And as you said, there was really good. I really enjoyed reading through the thread on the Guitar Nerds group, actually, with people kind of making their points for kind of you know, more traditional basses versus short scale. But one thing you were saying there made me think back to, I think I was in college. It was 10 years ago, anyway. So when I was young, essentially, and I was saying, oh, you know, I got to play this, you know, Fender Mustang bass in a store and it felt incredible and I really, really want to get it. And this was in audio college, and my lecturer at the time, who was kind of one of the sort of high ups, very experienced engineer in the college. And he said, yeah, you know, I like them. I think they're cool. They seem comfortable to play, but it's just the tonal content. You know, they're always so subby. They're like really hard to mix. They're really hard to, you know, kind of fit in with kind of a lot of band sounds outside of certain styles. And I think exactly like you say, I think, well, two things. I think, you know, there's been very few models that have kind of really existed in popularity on the market outside of the Fender Mustang over the years. And I think, obviously, we're talking about current times, but I certainly feel like the market has really grown and is continuing to grow with kind of more popular short scales actually having, in a sense, like market share now, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like you go on the big sites and you actually see categories for short scales as opposed to them being an add-on at the end of your list of kind of bases to peruse online or in stores.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the other things for short scale basses, I'll read. So this question came from Julie McFarling on our on the Facebook group, and she said, "I'm a guitarist looking to buy a bass guitar. Would it be good to get something like a short scale Mustang bass, or would it be better in the long run to go with a Fender P bass or Jazz bass?" That was the kind of question. There were lots of comments on it, and I commented on this saying, well, I disagree with a bunch of these, like, you know, because I was kind of like, I don't see the reason not to get a Mustang. One of the things I kept seeing coming up is like this whole, well, if you have smaller hands, you know, maybe a Mustang would be better. As if that's ever been, as if hand size, you could both disagree with me on this, but I'm kind of the mind like, as if hand size has ever made a difference, like on a short or a long scale bass. I don't think it ever has. If you're more comfortable with a guitar, I could see the advantage of a short scale bass. But otherwise, I think kind of, you know, you make they're just easier to play, like, and they're easier to play whether you've got small hands or large hands, you know. There's but I think with things like the Fender Player Mustang, which is one of Fender's most popular basses of the last 4 or 5 years since they've been making it, it started life as the offset, but understand that that bass is competing with the Precision and Jazz bass, you know, sometimes being above either of them as their bestsellers. That's a short scale, you know. That is now one of their most popular basses. It's why they introduce constant FSR models in different finishes. For the Player Mustangs, probably had more FSR color finishes than anything else Fender have made recently. The fact that they put PJ pickup configuration in it and a normal bridge instead of the Mustang bridge, that means you can buy that for whatever they cost, £600, £500, £600. You have something that sounds amazing, that has pickups that are tried and tested, so you can make it sound like a jazz bass, you can make it sound like a P bass, you can make it sound like a PJ bass, and it's easy to play, and you can upgrade the pickups easily. I feel like almost the argument against Mustangs is more to do with, yes, those small, that small split pickup is a particular sound, but it's not, it's the pickup we're talking about, not the scale of the instrument, that I think maybe that line gets muddied sometimes.
Yeah, I would agree with that, certainly. I do think, just to healthily rather than contentiously disagree with you on the hand size argument, I do think, and, you know, I'm biased. I have probably, like, you know, I'm a tall woman. I have average to large size hands. So I play really happily across short scale or sort of 34 inch scale instruments. But, you know, having taught some sort of kids and young people and, you know, trying to start them off on sort of a 34 scale and really seeing, you know, I'm teaching a group of four here and one of the four, you know, happens to have smaller hands and really is visibly struggling with learning this instrument. I do think that there are certainly people who will find one or other type more accessible. Like, absolutely, there are people who, you know, there are people who I know who play bass who argue that they find the higher frets in a guitar inaccessible, and they, you know, they wonder how their peers play super intricate solos, for example. So I do think there is a point there in terms of, let's say, accessibility. So I don't want to not...
No, sure. No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I'm thinking about it from quite a selfish perspective there.
I think we're right to chat about it, but I don't want to...
We're the world's number one guitar podcast.
But yeah, what I'm saying is I don't want to acknowledge that there are certain... certain limitations in taste, perhaps, beyond sort of sonically what we want or visually what we want in an instrument, which are fair to take into consideration. Particularly, I think, for young people kind of learning the instrument. I think if there's something that makes learning and the fundamentals of playing the instrument easier for you, then 100% go for that. You know, I had a few friends who started on, do you remember those P-Bass Juniors?
Oh my goodness, yes, yeah. I do.
Really cool. I'm pretty certain Joe Dart played one for a while.
Really?
was seen in some Wolfpack videos playing some. But yeah, I mean, they, you know, they were released as this sort of like youth student instrument, which I always thought was really cool. I don't think they lasted long on the market. I could be wrong. No. But certainly you certainly don't see them around much. But yeah, other than that, you know, I thought, as I said, there was some really good discourse about both sound and feel on Julie McFarlane's question. My experience certainly has been finding great aspects in both instruments, finding, you know, the more traditional 34-inch scale really enjoyable, really rock solid. And also, you know, also having struggles at points, you know, depending what key I'm playing in, sometimes finding, you know, the first to third fret exhausting to play versus the same on a short scale instrument. So it's I think my answer in the group to Julie's question was playing style and knowing your playing style. Should influence your decision, because I think, like you're saying, you know you can make either instrument into as much of a canvas as you want. Like we said with the Player Mustang, having the versatility of PJ, which I absolutely love. I'm really after coming full circle now with having sold my player PJ Mustang, I'm now back to wanting mine.
Yeah.
Did you? Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm back now to wanting another. So that'll be same. Two Broncos and a PJ Mustang, and I'm fine with that. I'm okay with that. Come fight me and my P bases and my three short scales if you all want. But yeah, I think you know, as with anything, and this is a little bit of a tough answer because Julie said herself she's a guitarist looking to buy a bass guitar, and obviously it's, you know, it's wrong to assume that you know your playing style and that you know exactly what you're going to be playing from the off. But I think style should influence the tools for the music, if you like.
You're completely right. It's something that I haven't thought about at all. But I guess one of the main reason that I'm becoming such an advocate of the short scale bass is awful lot of the stuff I do in Polymath is doubling up on guitar riffs.
Right. That's a really good point. Yeah.
And actually, it's some of those things are really hard, like especially when the guitarist in our band's in Fripp tuning. So his like things that might be the fret right next to it for him are sometimes a bit of a jump for me.
Yeah.
And certainly on a 34-inch scale, it's always an effort. And I think it was only when I picked up a short scale and started doing a lot of those things where I'm doubling up on quick riffs, and I was like, oh, he is not the genius guitarist I thought he was. I can do this too, you know. But
And that's awesome. Like, that's finding new... that's finding new tools for your artistry, which I absolutely love. It's like that feeling when you get a pedal that sort of makes your workflow far more concise than it had been. It's a really awesome kind of step forward in your own adventure with music.
Yeah, for sure. Now, JD, you like on this line of question, I appreciate when it comes to kind of us, like someone's like, oh, should I get a short scale or a long scale? And you know, sort of. Naomi and I, who both play a lot of short scales, I have a lot of both, but you know, like, and so does Naomi. But you know, as we both seem to be big fans of short scales, we're obviously going, yeah, this is a Mustang, which is, you know, one of my favorite instruments ever. You don't own any short scale instruments, and I think you've even said in the past that like that's one thing that you haven't fully embraced yet. Like, what are your reasons around that? I guess.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it for me is just like. It is the difference in feel more than anything. And like, I quite like fairly high tension sort of things. And even in like the choice of strings I use and everything, I like a more kind of rigid feel. But it's a lot of it is like a lot of the like techniques that I will use. Or like I do lots of bends and everything. And it's not that I want to work a bit at it, you know, but I sort of want like a hard like starting point without necessarily like raising action and without like really sort of changing it. It was always more about kind of feel for me. And you know, that being said, like the short scale basses I've played and I've liked a lot of the short scales better than a lot of other like 34, 35 inch scale basses that I've played as well. You know, like it's just, I've never really found one that really suited. And you know, it might be that it's because I like to play a lot of chords.
Right.
And for me, I really want like the higher tension kind of helps those all stay as intonated as possible, sort of without me needing to sort of like lightly bend things to sort of fit like on bass, or just I really think it is just more of a feel thing. And I know a lot of stuff is easier on with when things are a bit more slinky or, you know, like loose, but it's like for me, it helps my playing if nothing else when things aren't that slinky, because I will tend to, you know, over egg a bend, or I will you know, just like because I play hard, a lot of times will like tend to pull sharp,
right?
So like when things are, you know, and most of the stuff that I'm playing, like most of the music, it doesn't matter that I pull sharp, you know, like it's rock music. It's meant to be soundscapey. It's supposed to kind of be, you know, it's not like I'm playing in like a bass orchestra, which sounds horrific, by the way. But like playing in a bass orchestra.
Orchestra.
Yeah. Ugh. I mean, I've seen so many like at like bass events and stuff where everyone's like, hey, let's get 12 bass players all playing together. And
it happens to everyone.
Oh, God. It's like, why? It's bad enough listening to one YouTube bassist, let alone like five of them all just like playing what I affectionately call bucket of fish over and over again, which is the triplet that everyone does, right? And it's just like, where it's just like bucket of fish, bucket of fish, bucket of fish, bucket of fish.
Oh, so, yeah, it's yeah, yeah. It's the sonic equivalent of typing Google into Google. Like, God. It just shouldn't be done. It shouldn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's a cool fill, but like, once there's a two, when you have to, you know, like, as the first number, when you have to tell someone your age, like, stop doing it. Like, it's like, it's fine if the first number is a one or a zero. That's okay. You know, but like,
that's cute, in fact.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, oh, neat. It sounds like you're doing a thing.
Yeah. You're doing so well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's always where it's like, oh, you're playing a weird, like, you're playing Mustang Sally, right? And like, you don't need to do like Mustangs. Okay, cool. Was this My Name Is Mud Mustang? My Name Is Mustang Sally. The what was it? Pork soda version of yeah, oh, one dear. For the kids.
Wow. Oh, there you go.
Some fair points, JD. Brought to you by a group of actual bass advocates against bass orchestras.
They are weird. Yeah. They are such weird things. I mean, whenever I see the sort of big famous ones, you know, that generally have Billy Sheehan in them, and this is kind of credit to Billy Sheehan. If you watch those things, often he doesn't do a lot. Like, he's sitting at the back doing nothing, because I think deep down he appreciates how ridiculous this concept is. And he sits back and actually plays a bass line. Probably one of the only times he does that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, like, when it's his time to solo, he does his thing. And then you're like, great. And then like, it's just like, no one. It's like, just because you can do a thing doesn't mean you should do a thing, which is kind of counter to our Bronkoff anyway.
but like, careful now.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like, it's a little bit like the age old saying, play for the song, isn't it? Which is like, you know, do what's right to do here. You don't have to give this 200% just for the sake of it. You don't have to prove the maximum capacity of your musicianship in every single note that you play.
Well, I take issue with the musicianship comment in a lot of this.
In the context of a orchestra. I'm not calling it a bass orchestra anymore, by the way. I don't have time, so it's
bass
orchestra.
Circle tuggy wuggies.
The family-friendly version, I love it. That's really good.
A widow tuggy wuggies with their bass. Yeah, it's just, yeah, I mean, it's just like timbre-wise and the things that like a lot of even the best and most famous, rightly so, like bass players will do, like those things are like neat in like small doses, you know, like it's like the spice that's like, oh, that's nice. I don't want it in everything and all the time, but like, oh, that's really nice. It adds a little, that was really cool. Or it shows something like, because, you know, I've been to like just random like jazz gigs or something, and someone like a bass player will play something. And I'm like, oh yeah, that is nice. And it's like, and then I just trust everything else they're doing for the rest of the night. Right. Like, and it's like, that's interesting. But like when you get like 12 people, when there's no song, so there's no playing to the song anyway. And it's just like, well, let's just make up a version of like plickety plackety. And then like someone playing like chord changes, like hopefully somewhere along the lines, or, you know, like everyone playing some variation of their own groove. It's similar, like when you have like four drum, like any band that has multiple drummers except for Polymath, where you like where you're just kind of like, there's a bit of a beat, but I'm confused as to which one of you is playing which bits, you know, except for like seasoned bands that have that going on, where you have two percussionists who are approaching, you know, drums and like trading off in that conversation. Like it's just such an advanced thing to do that
yeah.
you can't just throw people up there and be like, okay, go.
Yeah, yeah. Everyone, like, everyone do yeah. the same thing, but times three, like yeah. or times two, or however many people are involved. Yeah, I think I do think that's a good point. There was a really good phrase that I heard, or like a remark that I heard.
Was it Tuggy Wuggy?
It wasn't. No, oh. That's the best phrase I've heard this evening, and will be taking with me into any other family friendly recordings where such terms are required in future. No, there was a term I heard which was actually feedback to a gig that I played with a band within the last sort of 2-3 years, but it was a project of my own, and we gigged. Somewhat prematurely, I think, when you're offered a gig and the project is almost ready and you're just so excited and you're so like nervous to kind of begin to get the music out there that you say yes before really thinking about it. And I was afforded some very honest feedback by a close peer friend. And we were speaking about, a section in one of the tunes, and I was saying, oh, you know, I think I really overcomplicated that in compositionally. And he said, I get you. I don't think it sounded bad, but I think it sounded like music for musicians, if you know what I mean. And I think music for musicians is a term that is just brilliant. It's like, you know, is it really written for a listener's ear, or is it written because, you know, you felt it, this was an impressive thing when you learned how to do it, and, you know, you want to show off this impressive thing rather than writing it in as part of a song, as part of a narrative or whatever story the music is supposed to be telling. But yeah, sometimes I find like orchestras, as in one instrument orchestras and really hyper specific ensembles like that, I find it a little bit music for musicians.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I think, yeah. I mean, I kind of feel like what you've described there is the entire math and prog rock genres. But
it's
a fine line to tread.
It is, yeah. And I smirk and note to you that said friend has been in math rock projects for many years. so perhaps not. Perhaps he was told it in his time. You never know.
It was probably a term of endearment that you took as criticism in an interesting way, because you're like, oh, I hear what you mean. But they are like, oh, it's music for musicians. The only kind of music that should ever be made ever.
Right.
And then divide by zero.
Well, yeah, I mean, funny you say, like someone could probably walk up to me and tell me I'm a fantastic person and I would still sob and take it as criticism, because that's just the sort of person I am. But I think there's certainly a twofold element to the remark. But in that sense, it was very healthy, constructive feedback regarding maybe overcomplicating a section in a song that didn't need to be so much so, and sounded a bit like music for musicians. But
I mean, if it's intentional, I think it's total. I mean, I also have a long history of music for musicianing.
Mm, so, mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I like.
Don't we all? Don't we all?
Yeah, I was like,
no, JT.
I don't even have music for musicians anymore. Music for like admins of Dune fan sites.
Yeah, it's just for algorithms. That's what it is now. That's all we're making music for. Now, JD, this next week, as things are kind of starting to open up a little bit in the UK at the moment, you're actually heading down to Bass Gallery, one of the UK's finest bass-specific guitar shops, Bass Gallery, which is in Camden. In London, dear listener, sorry for me to specify that for the global listener. It's an absolutely wonderful shop, Bass Gallery. It's absolutely packed with such a wonderful blend of like all basses. You know how like sometimes bass shops can be a little bit modern, like everything's on weird endangered wood and has five strings. I kind of think the Bass Gallery does an excellent job of having a bit of everything and a real kind of focus on awesome vintage stuff. So I thought, you know, I'd maybe ask you about, you know, if there are some specific things there that you're looking to check out when you get down there.
Yeah, I mean, primarily looking at, like, some of the stuff is just really interesting is, like, some of the heads they have. Like, I want to go play through a few things just to kind of have a bash, really. Like, there's and really just for some more variation from sort of my tried and true things that I have already, but there's some, like, they have a couple, like, vintage, which is weird saying that now, but it's like mid-90s, like Trace Elliott heads, which I used to have at some stage, but it'd be like, oh, it'd be cool to have that. They have a couple of the Trickfish heads, like the bullhead, like 0.5K and the 1Ks, and I really like Trickfish's stuff, so I just kind of want to get
I don't really know what Trickfish is.
Ah, Trickfish. So they're basically, it's US based company, but they have, like, just like, I find them, like, really, really good, clean, efficient, typically, you know, like solid state, but like very, very musical sounding, like you would get with like Walter Woods head, or even, like, you know, like some of the older GK heads and stuff like that. Like, they kind of give me those sorts of vibes. So they're fairly new-ish as a company. So they've been around a few years, but I've mostly seen them, you know, at NAMM and bass guitar shows and those sorts of things. And I've played them, but I was kind of thinking about really checking some of their stuff out, because, like, they're excellent people, first and foremost. Like, I've met a lot of the people that come in, they're all great, and everything they have, like, looks incredible and is, like, and sounds great. So I just kind of want to go play it in, like, kind of a more familiar format. Actually, it's probably more familiar to be at, like, NAMM and stuff than in a music shop for me. But, like, but, like, I want to be able to just, like, really kind of get a sense and play through some stuff there. They also have, like, an old Tech Sound Systems, like, Graphic 500 head. So, like, Tech Sound System was, like, I think it's probably, like, late 90s. I just remember I've never really played them. I remember, like, I used to play gigs with, like, a couple people that had them. They sounded fine. Because, like, they also played through like a Ken Smith or like a Padula or something, you know, like,
yeah.
Some weird, like, late 90s, you know, like, high-end bass, so I couldn't really tell. And so I just kind of wanted to check out, like, that kind of stuff. Like, I'm really into, like amps and stuff at the moment, like, looking at it. It sort of feels like a bit, like, nostalgic in the way that, like, someone will buy, like, G.I. Joe or Star Wars toys once they get, like, older, and they're like, well, this is also a personal story. I never had the USS Flag aircraft carrier. I really wish I would have, you know, like, I really wanted that for Christmas one year. My parents couldn't get it. Also, they told me it wouldn't fit in my room because it was 7 feet long. Whatever. I'll get it eventually. But, like, you know, so I kind of want to, like, kind of revisit a lot of those things. So there's just a lot of, like, amps and things I'm looking at. Also, you know, Earmuffs Joe, but, like, I want to go, like, some of the Ashdown heads and stuff like that. I, like, they have a couple of the CTMs there that I want to play through, like the CTM 100, and they have a 300. I know, just kind of want to compare those, because I was, you know, looking at kind of like that kind of head, which I don't have at the moment,
like a and big stuff like that. Valvey just, thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love a little valvey thing, but they don't have them. So, I mean, unless they, you know, they have like a CTM 30 in the back room, and in which case, it's probably coming back with me. but, like, so it's kind of mostly amps, and then really, like, bass wise, the stuff is, like, they have so much of the Blast Cult stuff, which I absolutely love. Like, tonally.
Explain to the listener a bit about that brand, because they are a very unique brand for if anyone's not seen them before.
Yeah, so Blast Cult used to be based in Southern California around the same time as I was based in Southern California. And primarily, initially started out, at least for my sense, making upright basses, mostly for, like, psychobilly, rockabilly, like Lee Rocker from Stray Cats.
So, dear listener, you get the idea of the look of these things from that description.
Yeah, they're very, very, like, yeah, that aesthetic, you know, which is certainly like mid-century vintagey, you know, like old Chevys and Mustangs and things like that kind of thing. And then they have like a hollow body flying V base, which is in like a, I think the one in their base gallery is like a gold sparkle.
Yeah.
You know, like something. It just absolutely really kind of not necessarily straight my vibe, but they have a, I can't remember the actual name of it offhand. I'll look in 1 second while talking about it, but it's, they do have a base that I have played before, maybe not this specific one, but it's 35-inch, 35-inch scale length, and it has like EMG single pole piece pickups.
Oh, that's so the that's the 35, I think, is
yeah,
the model.
Yeah, the 35. So, yeah. So it's basically like this, the same kind of pickups that you have on the high-end NS design uprights and stuff like that. So, and that bass, I have played it a few, like several years ago, and was absolutely blown away by like the workmanship and just like how big it sounded, but how also clear the definition was. And I, you know, I kind of talked about that on one of the episodes where we were talking about like kind of what's like sound we wanted. And for me, it was like, it's like a big bloom in the low end, but also like that throaty definition, like on top. And it, these bass absolutely had that on it. And so the guy that founded, and is the, you know, the main luthier for, and maybe only, I haven't looked yet, but like, for Blastcoat, like, relocated to London, so now they're right. London based, so which is why there's like so much in like bass gallery stuff. And so I
sure,
so hopefully it'd be cool at some point to like catch up with him, because like we've chatted a couple times 10 years ago, but it would be cool to like be like, hey, we're both here now, dude. Like let's, you know, let's look at these and check some of these basses out, because they're absolutely just, I mean, unreal. As far as everything I've seen, like their uprights are great, and it's, you know, it's much more difficult to make an upright than it is you know, solid body electric anything. So it's,
yeah,
just like,
of course,
to be able to like take, you know, take those kind of down, it's, yeah, excited to play those. I kind of want to have a little revisit. They have a couple Alembics there.
They do have an 8,000 pound Alembic.
That's, yeah, Stanley Clark one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, those are, it's a good price on a Stanley Clark Alembic these days. Mm. So I just, I mean, one, because like I'm quite familiar with Alembics. I think we talked about it on stage. But I'd like to revisit, you know, kind of those and just have like a, you know, it's kind of like a reset and recomparing like that bass to what's out there on the market today.
Yeah, exactly. Last time you played them was before the development. They were kind of the first, you know, one of the first sort of popular different models of the 90s.
Yeah, and you know, like, I mean, even in the 70s and stuff, you start looking at them and like they were light years ahead of everyone, but they're mostly unchanged since then, you know? Yeah. And it's like craftsmanship is off the charts. However, you know, like it's sort of like, well, what, you know, what's the difference between that and looking at like, you know, I mean, a Status, or looking at like even some of the stuff you could get from like Sandberg or something these days for, you know, 1.5 or something,
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah, and then, I mean, there's, yeah, it's really looking at, like, I really love old basses and used basses, you know, primarily anyway. So it's looking at some of the, just, I mean, because, you know, they have so much stuff there, like, in most times. I'm just, yeah, it's just like, it's the kind of place where, like, you could go to it every day of the week and still find something you missed the last time you were there.
Yeah, yeah. So true. Yeah. You could also go there with most budgets in mind and find something, which I absolutely adore about Bass Gallery. Like, on top of it being, you know, super vibey, amazing service, like all the staff there are so friendly and so helpful. It's like you can still walk in with, you know, sub £500 and possibly walk out with a cool, unusual bass. Like, I know they have some, like, I think they call them Bitsa bases, which I think is like maybe like Warmoth type builds, and you know they're really really well priced, but it, you know, it seems like their product vetting is absolutely superb, but they're not allergic to kind of lower price points, which is really really admirable, I think, in an otherwise super premium gallery setting.
Yeah, it just, everything feels, what it really feels like to me is like a well curated playlist. In a way of like, anything you want to get, it's like, I know that anything here is going to be good.
Yeah.
And I trust that you go in and like, you know, you go in and you say like, hey, this is what I'm looking for. I kind of do this. And so, and you're like, all right, so what, you know, like price point wise, what are you really thinking?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you're like, oh, actually, this would be the best thing for you, you know? And yeah. Oh, and the other thing, yeah, there's so much there I really want to check out, like, and just really, again, because it's that curated thing, it's like, it's not like me going to a shop that is a big mass chain, not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's like, when you go to like a big mass chain, you're like, oh, it's clear that like, and like me from my slightly jaded, you know, behind the scenes, knowing how all this works, kind of stuff, being like, okay, so these are the two brands that you have and you don't have anything, you know, it's like, well, I go here if I want to get this amp, or I go over to this shop if I want to get that, you know, it's like a,
yeah,
you know, Coke or Pepsi at a restaurant kind of thing.
Yeah, like I know you stock this range and that range, and I know I can come here for these widely available things.
Yeah, you know, it's like, it's great that I can, you know, like at basically, like I can go look at, which I may be doing, go look at like a six string Stonefield, and also one of those Traben basses.
That guitar is £4,700. The six string Stonefield.
Yeah, from Bassguard.
Right? Yeah. yeah, true. I tell you what, they actually have a Zon Legacy 5 as well.
Oh yeah,
Please try it and tell me how good it is. So
we can chip in like we're shared ownership.
JD, actually, I've also spotted a few other bases that have popped up on our podcast chats as well, including an Asinonyx base.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there's a white one with a torque guard for £750.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Yeah, please play. Please report back on that one. $750
is such a good shout for the, like,
oh, it's a great price.
I've played those. Those bases are, if I wasn't going full bronchophilips like quite soon, then it would be really hard not to pick one. Like it was unreal. Like they're such good fun bases, but like, I mean, some of the Blast Cult, like the 35s, it's going to be really hard for me to, like, it's very rare that I remember messaging multiple friends about a bass I played, mm-hmm. like at a show, being like, oh my god, if you ever get a chance to play one of these, you have to, I think you would absolutely love it. And like that Blast Cult 35 is one that I did that to multiple people, and again, like, I don't know if it's necessarily fully my vibe, but I want to check in and I want to see, like, if it's one that's been made here, is it living up to my, like, what my memory was, or was I just, you know, surprised at the time because, you know, like, it was new and different and felt good. They just have so much stuff. They have a lot of, like, late 70s. PJ bases there, like always, but like now it looks like they have quite a few, and you know, check those out. It's just such a really cool shop, and it's like, I love, mostly I'm just stoked to go to like a music shop and just be able to, you know, just be able to be like, oh, look at all this stuff, like it's all stuff that's not the same stuff that I've had around me the whole time.
Yeah, it's a welcome return for sure, isn't it? I mean, yeah, I know I certainly locally did plenty of standing like a child with my, well, a child or a massive creep with my face and hands pressed to store windows looking at the cool vintage stuff inside. So it's nice to herald an end to that and getting to actually walk around. My apologies, JD, I forget if you said you had or hadn't tried them, but I think there's some connection, but I know Base Gallery always do stock a load of Wilcox as well.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, definitely well worth a play if you've not tried Wilcox bases already. That was the one place I've got to try them so far, and I was super impressed with those.
Yeah, I'll definitely check them out again, because like they were, I have played them, but not
right,
not in any. Again, it was at NAMM, and it was
sure.
I used a Wilcox base to try out something else.
Yeah, I got you.
And so it wasn't the focus of your yeah.
Yeah,
and so like yeah, it was. But I remember being like, oh, this is nice, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was mostly that was it, and it was also, you know, 200 dB of bucket of fishing around me.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
stuff at the time. But yeah, so yeah, I'll definitely try out some of those, because I mean they always look. What I've always liked about the Wilcox is like they always look like a really interesting combo for me between like a telly or like an infield or like mm-hmm. a wall, like in some way.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like it feels like, oh, that's cool.
They definitely look like retro walls to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've always got that vibe too. There's one which I'm wondering, is it the same one I tried, but hardly. It might just be a spec that they do, but I think it was called the MM at the time, because it has an MM pickup in, but basically it's like this racing bright orange with matching headstock, and it's a long scale. I know they're really into short scales otherwise, but it's so super smart looking, just one big fat humbucker in there, super simple controls. And when I tried it was like, I can only really compare it to like a long scale version of the Watt Plower in terms of how much like sonic attitude and crazy good playability it had. But yeah, super cool bass by them.
I mean, yeah, just like, I mean, I hadn't actually really perused the website that much, but there's just so much here that this could be. Luckily, I have to be back. So this isn't going to be like a full day thing. But like, there's just so much. There's so much I just miss playing, because I'm so used to playing all kinds of different stuff all the time.
Of course.
That it's just like, oh, I realize I haven't done that. And what normally happens is I'm always like, oh, this is all, you know, like I get to go have my fun with the olives and then come back and be like, well, I like what I have. That's a Peep Show reference. And then, I just really, really excited just for like other stuff and to see like what stuff's there and like, I'm not so desperate that I'm going to end up with like one of the Jackson, like Dave Elfson, Kelly bases or something, you know, which are cheap enough that you could be like, oh, that's like 400 quid. I might as well. Like, why not? But,
it's going to be very exciting. I'm very jealous that you get to go to such one of the best bass shops that the UK has to offer.
Yeah.
So I hope you have a great time. That is actually all the time we have on this week's regular episode of the Guitar Nerds podcast. You can, of course, dear listener, join us over on Patreon at patreon.com/guitarnerds for an entire extra episode every week. This week, we're going to be continuing over there. We're going to be talking about almost the opposite of these the wonderful high-end things from Bass Gallery. We're going to be talking about Carl Harris's question from last week about the best things to buy for under $400. And we're going to be talking about that when applied to bass guitars, amongst other questions, maybe, from the group. But you can become a Patreon supporter for as little as $1 a month. At the dollar tier, you'll get this episode ad-free and early every week. $5 a month gets you access to the Patreon special episodes and our entire back catalogue, which is very substantial. It's like 600 episodes of back catalogue. And at the $10 tier, you get the lot plus. I'll sing you my thanks at the end of every episode. You can find us on all your favorite social media platforms, and you can join the Guitar Nerds group on Facebook to get involved in our weekly episode discussion. Thanks for listening. You've been lovely. We've been the Guitar Nerds. Farewell.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Goodbye.
some love, I know you wanted to. Checking on the guitars when you're feeling cool. You're a Telecaster and a Stratocaster fan. You're also a Gwiddler and a bit of music man. You take one look at a Fender custom shop, you know that that's another $3,000 you're gonna drop. And I love 50s, cute, so unique. Now go on, buy the plugin from the plugin of the week. Guitar nerds coming in your ears, listen to us day and night and drink a bunch of beers. We got Matt Knight and Jay Cross too. Packing even shows up when he's got nothing to do. We got JD and Naomi McCloud, but I am the best one cause I'm sexy jumping loud. But we couldn't do this podcast without you. You're everything a podcast host could ever want is true.
You're listening to this Patreon song. Imagine I am wearing a polka dot suit. I whip it off and I windmill my ding dong.
Holly Simpson, Eric Vaughn, John Conway, Jonathan Hafferty, James Dorr, Paul Drew, Russell Healy, and Yogi the guitarist, Ty Allen, Carl Harris, Cloud Lifter, Todd Sons, Sean Hughes, Joe Hubbard, Brian Hansen, Shane, Eric, Emma, Jeffrey Wax, Andrew Frost, Brian Ansel, Gavin Vanderlind, and Adam Manley, Robert Butter, what's got out of Mark Kazow, Catterwick, Simon Miller, Vaughn, Stuart Robinson, Christian Lund Hansen, Keith Adams, Michael McCray, Eric Clow, Ryan McDonough, Jay Cumber, Larry Peters, Joe Paddock, Ken Sayers, Abe Matthews, Victor B of the band, Sean Albo, John Angler, Ernie Cooper, Ross Edwards, Nate Nagle, Stephen Burke, Dave Lee, J. Gray, Scott Kennedy, Blake Ryland, Christopher Mason, Hans Hans, Derek Rich, Rob Rodman, J.D. Schwartz, Steve Burke, Andy McKenzie, Brad Page, Robert Stewart, Scott O'Brien, Paul Corrigan, Moo Gravett!